Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege to be here on the Freedom Forum. The erosion of the American tradition has gone a long ways. A friend of mine was telling me the other day a story, I don't know whether it's true or not, about a friend of his who has a young son. He noticed that the boy of 8 or 9 was developing tendencies which suggested that he was on the way to the White House in the present tradition. Father became worried, wondered what he could do to prevent his son from lying so much. And so he finally told him the story of George Washington and the cherry tree. And he said to his son, the elder Mr. Washington was out and he noticed that there was a cherry tree cut down. And over there was little George. Little George was standing with a hatchet in his hand. So his father went over and asked him about the cherry tree. Little George said, Papa, I cannot tell a lie. I did it with this little hatchet. And now, my son, do you know George's father did not punish him? And do you know why he did not punish him? The boy said, why, sure. He knew better than to get fresh with a kid who's got a hatchet. Well, I do not know to what extent we have completely lost contact with our American heritage. One reason that we have is that we have permitted ourselves over the years to be contaminated with a socialist ideology which merely cleared the way for the international communist conspiracy whose real essence you have just seen in this very fine film. I have been asked to speak to you today about socialism as distinct from communism. Now, that is a subject that we can treat. But when we try to discuss socialism as something different from the international communist conspiracy, we are essentially in the position in which we should be if we tried to discuss Russia without speaking about the Soviet Union. In other words, until about 1850, you can discuss the history of Russia, and you will find in it at most a few preliminary signs, a few antecedents that might suggest the coming of the communist conspiracy. By about 1870, you couldn't really discuss Russian history without taking up the nihilists, the early form of the communist conspiracy in that country. And after 1917, of course, the two would become simply one subject. In the United States today, of course, socialism and the international communist conspiracy are a single subject, divisible only in the minds of some dreamers. Now, that's not to say that there is no distinction between socialism and the communist conspiracy anywhere in the world. There are two obvious exceptions, states that we generally describe as socialistic. They do have a limited form of socialism. New Zealand and Sweden. Both are, to a large extent, limited welfare states. And it is an astonishing fact that in New Zealand, in the opinion of the most experienced observers, both there and outside, the extent of communist infiltration is, as yet, small, less than 20%. In Sweden, of course, the infiltration is much greater and the degree of control is much greater. But despite its proximity to the Soviet, the communist control in Sweden is certainly no greater than in the United States, that is to say, above 50%, between 50 and 60, should we say. Note, however, that both of these are small countries, that neither could dream of playing a role as a world power, and that neither has felt a great need to defend itself. New Zealand has a largely agrarian economy, and a remarkably homogeneous population of British origin. It is essentially a pastoral land, although I admit that if you look at Wellington, you receive a different impression. And for most of its history, New Zealand has rested under the shield of the British Empire. And now that the British Empire has almost completed the process of committing suicide, New Zealand looks to Australia and perhaps still cherishes some illusions about the United States. Sweden, to be sure, is an industrial nation. Its foreign policy has for decades been simply that of staying on good terms with the winning side in any European war. Many people doubt that Sweden would fight today even to protect its own territory from invasion, even to save its own population. That, of course, is something you can't predict until the event occurs. Sweden, however, is a model welfare state and has all the blessings of a welfare state, almost universal promiscuity, one of the highest rates of both abortion and suicide in the world, chronic alcoholism, and a strangely predominant social atmosphere of a kind of perverted pessimism, a feeling that life is not really worthwhile. Now, their limited approach to socialism is, of course, Sweden's own business, since it in no way represents a threat to us. And the Swedish people are conducting an experiment that will be extremely interesting and indeed valuable and informative to historians if it is carried on long enough to give clearly measurable results. The Swedes are undoubtedly one of the most gifted nations of the world in their biological inheritance. The welfare state will very probably result in biological deterioration, a deterioration which could certainly be measured in 100 or perhaps even 50 years. That would be an important historical datum. The sad thing, of course, is that from the standpoint of the historian, Sweden may not complete its experiment. It's not likely to be there long enough for the experiment to yield measurable results. Now, socialism is one of the very few patterns of social organization available to mankind. We hear so much piffle and twaddle these days about a new era and ever-increasing complexity and a changing world that we sometimes forget that human relationships are necessarily simple, necessarily unchanging, because human nature cannot change and because human nature permits only a few patterns. The hogwash about new ideas that is peddled by our self-styled social scientists is partly a reflection of their simple ignorance of history and partly an illusion generated by enfevered imaginations. There is nothing left to invent in the realm of human values and human relationships. Some of you have doubtless read one of the versions of Pierre Louis' delightful little tale in which he imagines that his apartment in Paris was visited by Cleopatra, returned from the dead. Louis says that he tried to impress Cleopatra by describing the great progress made since her day and by celebrating the triumphs of modern invention. But Cleopatra said, "Ah, yes, but have you invented a new sin?" There are no inventions to be made in either sins or other human relations. They're limited by nature. Consider, for example, the most basic relationship of all, marriage. There are and there can be only three kinds of marriage: monogamy, polygyny, and polyandry. And I defy the most progressive, overheated brain in our brain factories to invent a fourth. Of course, there are alternatives, promiscuity on the one hand and complete celibacy on the other, but neither are marriage. Both are the negation of it. In that field, mankind has exhausted the possible combinations. The views of these combinations depend partly on cultural tradition, partly perhaps on race, They lead to generalizations and conclusions that are often inaccurate, historically and factually. I remember that a number of years ago, I had the privilege of hearing a Hindu princess, and that is no very great and distinguished title. She was the wife of one of the grandsons of one of the almost innumerable Rajas, not Maharajas. A woman of very considerable education, great education, in fact. She was particularly had studied French as a result of her family's antipathy towards England and hence the English language. And she was holding forth with this thesis that no woman in the Western world loves her husband. It's perfectly obvious that Western women, European and American women, are simply mercenary. They're interested only in finding someone to support them. And that, she said, was perfectly obvious because if Western women loved their husbands, why, they would, of course, insist on polygamy. Now, she believed that. It is an arguable point of view. However, there will be objections to it, and if you don't believe that, just try the argument on your wife. It would be hard to account for so great a difference in tradition. That is one of the problems of history and of this new discipline that we call historiognomy, or meta-histoire in French, that tries to evolve a theory of history, a doctrine of culture, from the recorded facts. Another fundamental difference, surely as fundamental as the one that I have just mentioned, is in views of social organization. We represent Western civilization and its long continuity. And we therefore represent the only people who have ever had a conception of self-government. By tradition, or possibly by racial characteristic of the mind, the other civilizations, if I may now use that term in the Spenglerian sense, and admit that there are more than one, the other civilizations have never understood the concept of self-government. All you have to do is look at a work such as the Fusal al-Madani of al-Farabi. This was a Muslim scholar, really a scholar, in that brief period sometimes called the Islamic Renaissance, when under the influence of Greek learning, a very considerable intellectual activity characterized a certain part of the Muslim world. This man has read Plato and Aristotle. He has consequently read their theories of government. He has undoubtedly read the Aristotelian and Platonic discussions of democracy and aristocracy and such matters. But he can't conceive of anything but a despotism. What he has read is meaningless to him. He undoubtedly granted that, yes, Plato and Aristotle had said that. But he had read them much as you might read the Homeric poems on the subject of war. You're willing to believe in these poems. You're willing to recognize the great poetry in them. But it would never occur to you as feasible to fight a 10-year war for the recovery of Helen of Troy or even Greta Garbo. It simply would not enter your mind that that was a conceivable international policy at the present time. Likewise, Al-Farabi does not even consider, as more than an odd characteristic of the Greeks not worth mentioning, their conception of self-government. I think it will pay us to consider for a moment the origin of civilized society. As I say, I use civilization in the current Spenglerian sense, in which you can speak of a number of civilizations having flourished on the surface of this earth. Before Spengler, of course, the word was not one that you could use in the plural. Civilization meant Western culture, the culture that has been sabotaged, obscured, and all but obliterated. That was civilization. Everything else was barbarism. But given the Spenglerian doctrine, we now speak of civilization's considerable number, six or seven for practical purposes in Spengler. Toynbee tries to run the score up to 30. And to a certain extent, there is validity in this conception. I'm only sorry that we had to use the word civilization to describe it. There are these parallel developments of societies. I wish that Spengler had thought of some other term, because I think that the 18th and 19th centuries distinction, the distinction that has been fundamental in Western thought since the Renaissance, that on the one hand you have Western culture, which is a unique creation, on the other hand you have barbarisms, which may be magnificent, which may be impressive, but which do not really have the same standard of values or a comparable standard of values to our own. However that may be, let us consider the origin of society. We are so often assured that we live in a changing world, and we're so pleased by the progress of our technology that we sometimes imagine the change, or at least the rapidity of it, is a peculiarity of our time, an originality of which we are as proud as an adolescent who has just discovered that he is in love. Now, the most drastic and rapid social change that mankind ever experienced took place approximately 5,000 years ago in Egypt. I say approximately 5,000 years ago. As you know, the chronology of early Egyptian history has been shortened in the past 40 years by the revisions that successive scholars have introduced. The longer chronology of Flinders Petrie, as I believe, almost discarded by most men in the field. Consequently, approximately 3,000 years ago, to be more 3,000 years B.C., 5,000 years ago. To be more precise, it would be necessary to go into a very long discussion. I'm also going to ignore the question of what was happening in Sumeria more or less contemporaneously. Recent scholars are tending to update events in Sumeria even more than in Egypt. And I also dodge the question of why this happened. Every once in a while, an Egyptologist will produce a book to argue that what happened was that Egypt was invaded by a small group of warriors from the north. For that he can make a plausible case, but he cannot prove it. Most Egyptologists regard the developments as entirely indigenous. For that they can make a very good case, although it is a negative one. They argue that it must be indigenous because there are no positive evidences a foreign invasion. Whatever the cause, the change was sudden. A great Egyptologist, Professor John A. Wilson, has compared it to the speed with which a supersaturated solution crystallizes in a flask. And it was drastic. Within a century, the Egyptians were hustled from barbarism to civilization. At the beginning of that period, they were roughly comparable to our Indians of the Southwest. The Indians in their adobe villages before the coming of the white man, a timeless people, without a past to remember or a future to plan, a people for whom tribal mores took the place of formal government or social organization, a people that could live almost entirely by instinct, since the monotonous collection of food was varied only by an occasional raid on a neighboring village for exercise. At the end of the century, however, Egypt was a nation that extended from the first cataract to the Mediterranean and subject to the absolute rule of a completely centralized and socialist government. The force that produced this change must have been a force exerted on a number of people, a very large number of people, who probably were not reluctant when the change overtook them, because they had not accustomed themselves to thinking in terms of a future, but who must sooner or later have begun to look back on that at that beautiful era when they were like the Indians in their adobe villages and could live almost entirely by instinct and had nothing to look forward to. There is no real historical evidence, but just human probability makes it certain that in Egypt at this time, what we call civilization was a veneer as thin as the veneer that is civilization for us. Perhaps the most fundamental fact that we forget, and forget to our tragic undoing, is that civilization is a thin crust that is hardened over yet molten lava. It is probable that at any part of the world, a large number, quite probably a majority of the inhabitants, do not really think about the culture that is theirs. Every night, the subways of our great cities carry homeward thousands and thousands of people who understand no more of our society than does a leopard in his cage at the zoo. They follow a routine. They have a job. They have, I hope, some little sense of moral values. Although if you watch them piling on the subway in New York City, you wouldn't believe it. But as for any comprehension of a conscious purpose in Western civilization or in the United States of America or in New York City, they simply do not have it. Well, in Egypt then, with all of this latent resentment in the mass that had been civilized, there was for the first time in man's long existence on this planet a nation. And that nation's resources were consciously marshaled and used by a government which necessarily planned for the future. Writing and written records appeared suddenly to make possible the bureaucracy that managed the nation. And the intelligent direction of human efforts soon required or induced technical accomplishment. At the end of the second dynasty, there was nowhere on the surface of the earth a permanent structure. Nothing had ever been built of stone. Within 100 years from the end of the second dynasty, Egypt had erected the most enduring structure that man has ever built. What was, until quite recently, both the tallest and the most massive building in the world. It was also one of the most accurately constructed. The 2.5 million blocks of stone in the Great Pyramid were faced with blocks, many of them weighing 16 tons, which were finished to a tolerance of plus or minus 1/100th of an inch. Now, when civilization had come to Egypt, it must have seemed eternal. It was, of course, designed like the pyramids for all time. For reasons made clear by Carl A. Wittvogel in his excellent book, Oriental Despotism, published at New Haven in 1957, the earliest and most primitive form of civilized society is always socialism. That is to say, an omnipotent central government with a completely managed economy and with the inhabitants reduced to the kind of serfdom that our planners in Washington are now imposing step by step on the American people. The Egyptian definition of the good state was one in which, quote, well directed are men, the cattle of God. Men were simply the cattle of Pharaoh, who had all the power that Jack Kennedy craves, and who was by definition the son of God, and therefore God himself. He owned every acre of ground, every house, every stick of wood in Egypt from the first cataract to the Mediterranean, and he naturally owned all the livestock on that plantation, both quadruped and biped. A total socialism, such as Egypt had from the beginning, necessarily excludes all thought of change. That fact, I think, very largely explains its appeal to men. The many hundreds of utopias that have been imagined by idle dreamers, from Romulus to Sir Thomas More to Edward Bellamy, differ greatly in their details, but they have one thing in common. They imagine a state in which no governmental or social change is possible or even conceivable. And the sincere socialists of our own time, although of course they're vociferous in praise of the inevitable change leading to socialism, promise us the joys of a social order that can never again change and will be immutable forever and forever in saecula saeculorum, or at the very least, till the sun grows cold and the stars are old. Necessarily, therefore, the basic assumption of Egyptian civilization was that it was a social order as eternal as the granite of its monuments. But 400 years after Cheops built his pyramid, that order suddenly disintegrated into anarchy and utter chaos. The one thing that we know with certainty about the causes of the collapse is that they were internal. Egypt was not invaded by a foreign people and was not involved in a major war or even any military action other than the routine policing of the few points at which she was not isolated from the rest of the world by natural barriers. There appears to have been a steady trickle of immigration across the Isthmus of Suez into Egypt, but there is no reason to suppose that the immigrants were sufficiently numerous and active either to affect the character of the Egyptian population or to attempt an insurrection. If you look for eternal causes, you note, of course, that the last king before the collapse, Pepe II, ruled for 90 years, which suggests that if he did not begin his reign as God in diapers, he must have ended it as God in a state of senile imbecility, thus possibly inspiring one of his sons or grandsons or great-grandsons with impatience to start enjoying the blessings of divinity himself. But that's a mere guess. No one really knows what the spark was that set off the explosion. Could have been a civil war for possession of the throne. But whatever the source of the spark, it is clear that the explosive materials lay deep in the structure of the society they destroyed. Since a small body of writing, especially the lamentations of Ippur and Neferuhu, who witnessed the collapse, has survived, modern historians can learn a good deal about the causes. You'll find them discussed at length in any good history of ancient Egypt. What happened in Egypt was not a mere political upheaval to change the ruler or form of government. It was the ruin of a whole civilization through the collapse of its moral foundations. Ippur tells us, if three men go along a road, they become two men, for the greater number kills the lesser. And Neferuhu, I show thee the brother as an enemy, and the man who kills his own father. Every mouth is full of love me, and everything good has disappeared. Sounds very modern. Order had vanished in anarchy and in universal banditry, and no man knew when he would be struck down from ambush or murdered in his own house. Yes, his own house. For the Lamentations incidentally show us that during the centuries preceding the collapse, the perfect socialist state under its incarnate God had not been able to maintain its pure form. It had somehow progressed from socialism toward a higher form of social organization in which there was private property, not only in practice, as of course has to be in any society, but probably also in theory. The writers take it for granted. Neferohu complains that men take a man's property away from him, and it is given to him who is from outside. I show thee the owner in need and the outsider satisfied. The phrase, by the way, that is translated him who is from outside just means that. It's hard to, you couldn't put a more specific modern meaning to it without running the risk of falsifying the text. I suppose it means the stranger, the person who is not an owner of the property, possibly a person who is not a participant in the civilization. Epuwar goes on to say, the robber is now the possessor of riches. The children of great men are dashed against the walls. Great ladies now glean in the fields. The owners of fine robes are clad in rags. But he who never wove for himself is now the owner of fine linen. End quote. It's clear that Egypt had risen, though perhaps precariously, to a level far above pure socialism, and that must have made the collapse the more terrible. Now, of course, Egypt eventually recovered from the chaos that historians euphemistically call the first intermediate period. And she went on to complete with many vicissitudes her 3,000 years as a great and independent nation, a record that only China can rival. But men who witnessed the collapse could not foresee that. The apparent end of human civilization, overthrown by a barbarism made more savage and terrible because it had captured the weapons and resources that civilization had produced, must have been a traumatic shock unsurpassed thus far in the experience of mankind. Contemporaries felt utter despair. Neferohu concluded, the land is completely perished so that no remainder exists. And Epuwer could only regard mankind as a failure and wish that it would disappear. He says, ah, would that it were the end of men, that there were no conception and no birth. Then would the earth cease from turmoil and be at rest. Did not occur, by the way, to either Neferohu or Epuwer, nor so far as we know did it occur to any later Egyptian, to ask why the catastrophe had befallen them. That, by the way, is an interesting datum to be taken into consideration. Neferohu was, of course, quite right when he said, what has never happened has happened. You could not have expected him to have constructed a historical parallel. There was none available. But it seems that at no time in their long existence as a nation did the Egyptians think in terms of historical causes and effect. They compiled chronologies, but they never wrote history. And it could be argued that history, in the sense of the reasoned reporting of political and social change, was the product of the Greek mind, and perhaps confined only to our own civilization, which has inherited the Greek tradition, and to such peoples as the Greeks influenced, as, for example, in the Muslim, so-called Muslim Enlightenment. But that would be a long argument. The most perfect socialist state known to history, however, was not Egypt. It was located in what is now modern Peru, Ecuador, little of northern Chile, and of western Bolivia. It was the state that was ruled by the Incas, and sometimes we improperly refer to the people as Incas. Inca, of course, is a term which means essentially the same thing as Pharaoh. I cannot go into this culture, but I do suggest to you an extremely enlightening book by Louis Baudin. It's L'Empire Socialiste des Incas, published by the Institut d'Ethnologie in Paris in 1928. A good deal of information concerning the Incas can be had from a book that now appears in a paperback on most of the newsstands by Victor von Hagen called The Realm of the Incas. This, as I say, was the perfect socialist state. It was of rather recent origin. The first Inca, Manco Capac, ruled approximately 1100 AD, perhaps a little earlier. And of course, the nation lasted in isolation with no foreign enemies other than barbarian tribes on its border until 1532, when Francisco Pizarro and 130 foot soldiers took over an empire of many millions of people. Here again, you get into historical questions that are ardently debated. Was the Inca culture indigenous, or was it imported from abroad? There is a good deal of evidence that it may have been imported. For one thing, who carried cotton to the land of the Incas? It must have been done by men. Cotton is not an indigenous plant to the Western Hemisphere. It has a culture that in many ways resembled that of the first dynasties of Egypt. Very high degree of skill in architecture, in ceramics, in agriculture, and in animal husbandry. As you all know, that useful beast, the llama, has to be artificially bred. It will not reproduce itself. On the other hand, they had no literature or higher culture or history because they had no writing. They had merely oral traditions. However, they did have a highly elaborate system of bookkeeping by means of the quipu, the knotted threads, which make possible the compilation of statistics. And since the threads have color, they can be coded, much in the way that telephone wires are coded in a conduct now. And consequently, the statistics of a whole empire were preserved in literally miles of knotted thread. There were certain points of resemblance to Egypt that seem somewhat remarkable. The Incas, of course, like the pharaohs, always married their own sisters. In Peru, that privilege was not extended to the rest of the population as it was in Egypt. They were always embalmed. The Incas were regarded as the sons of the sun, again as in Egypt. The pharaoh was the son of Ra, the son of the sun, therefore the son of God. And of course, when he died, he returned to his home in heaven and was succeeded by his divine offspring. Of course, there are also differences between the Inca culture and the Egyptian, and I'm not suggesting that it was an Egyptian colony, although one is tempted often to think in those terms. But the Inca society, as I say, perfect socialism. Everybody was supervised from the womb to the tomb. You had a very elaborate bureaucracy. For each 10,000 inhabitants, there were 1,121 supervisors. And that's even better than the New Deal has succeeded in doing thus far. The great bureaucracy was composed largely of descendants of the Inca. The Inca, given the fact that he, unlike his subjects, enjoyed polygamy, was in a better position than, let us say, the Kennedy clan is to staff the bureaucracy. It was not unusual for a living Inca to have 500 living descendants in the male line, so he could make a considerable contribution to the progress of his country, you see. As in Egypt, he was the owner. He owned everything, and he took care of everybody. Nobody had any worries. Didn't even have to worry about what to do with his leisure time, because that was organized, taken care of for him. All he had to do was do what he was told to do. He was owned by the Inca, as everything else was. And the Inca, well, it was a privilege to belong to him. He was the son of the sun. He was divine. And as a matter of fact, socialism seems to have worked very, very well in Peru. History knows no evidence of discontent. No people in the world seems ever to have been more satisfied with its form of government. This state of general euphoria may have been heightened by two advantages that the Incas enjoyed in the governing of their subjects. The first was that the race had endemic syphilis. As you know, there are great differences in racial reaction to that disease. It is a disease that, if unchecked, becomes fatal to white men. To the Indian population of Peru, it was something like chronic sinus trouble and produced mere stolidity. Doesn't seem to have impaired fecundity at all. And so maybe that would contribute to a pleasant and happy socialist society of the United States, if we were to have one. And I pass the suggestion on to the Bureau of Health, Education, and Welfare. The other thing that contributed to the stability of the Inca regime, perhaps, was the availability of coca, the leaves that are the principal source of cocaine. The first Spaniards differ considerably in their account as to how widely these leaves were used. I cannot say that the whole population went around happily chewing cocaine all the time. That is a possibility. Some Spaniards report that cocaine was reserved for the upper classes. Sort of reminds one of the New Deal and Harry Hopkins. However, the Inca regime deserves study. This is socialism at its most successful. Because remember, socialism implies the economic governance of society, and that implies a centralized government, and that implies a bureaucracy. And the bureaucracy has to rest its power on absolutes. Currently, of course, in various other societies for a time, it can get by pleading that it has expertise or some other special quality that makes it superior to ordinary human beings. But eventually, a bureaucracy has got to get down to fundamentals and absolutes. And that means that it's got to have not merely an absolute monarch, but it's got to have an incarnate God. The process of evolution in Rome, you all know too well for me to do more than merely mention it. But notice that with the first revolutionary who succeeds in overthrowing the Republic, Julius Caesar, he becomes Divus Iulius after his death. And Augustus is content to be regarded as merely the adopted son of a divinity during his own lifetime, and to make sure that he will be raised to heaven as soon as he dies. But as the bureaucracy expands, and it has to, because once it has started strangling the economy of a nation, it's got to go ahead and sink its tentacles, wrap its tentacles tighter, sink its mandibles deeper into the society, you eventually come out with Diocletian, who just frankly proclaims that he is Dominus et Deus. He is master and God, and that is that. This desire to see a divine or quasi-divine being at the head of so mundane and necessarily corrupt a thing as a government is a tendency that is necessary for the success of socialism. You may have noticed that in recent years, the great warlords of the world, Roosevelt, Hitler, Stalin, Lenin, were all adored as somehow superhuman beings, as saviors of a kind, adored with a completely irrational fanaticism. I remember having been in Washington the day of an event that was much celebrated even in New Deal circles. The news of Roosevelt's death was withheld for hours until the liquor stores could be closed and so on. I happened to be eating dinner in a dining room in the place where I was then working with a young lady who was one of my most competent assistants. And we were eating quietly at the table. This was fairly well on in the evening. I've forgotten how late it was. But the news was already out. And there came approaching us a woman. I later discovered she belonged to another branch. She was a college graduate. Not only that, she had a master's degree and had done some work toward a doctorate. And I would say she was not by any means a co-ed. She was, well, let's say a little above 30, tears streaming down her face and dripping over her dress. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? He has left us. Well, I told her I was going to eat dinner with a better appetite than I had had for years. And while I found her amusing, and by the way, it's a very interesting psychological fact that I cannot explain, for she was simply livid at my reply. But she didn't try to attack me. But she almost attacked physically this lady who was with me and who had been discreet enough not to say anything in that little conversation. But it is curious, this cult of the Superman. One of the most alarming things in recent years was one of the reactions to the great communist campaign against the anti-communists that Dr. Benson mentioned in his opening address. After the orders went out on the 5th of December 1960, of course, the American comrades and their tools began to spit and puke at all American conservatives through their favorite channels, the People's World, Time, New York Times, Newsweek, The Worker, so on. And one of their principal targets was, of course, an American society that the communists fear perhaps more than any other. And their principal target was the great American patriot who's head of that society, Mr. Robert Welch. And these vermin dug up a quotation from a letter, which they'd succeeded in stealing a copy, that was critical of Dwight D. Eisenhower. Now, this was usual spear technique, of course. The thing that alarmed me was the success of it. The great number of American people who were willing to regard criticism of an American president as something impious, something unholy, something nefarious, something you shouldn't do. In a nation capable of governing itself, in a nation of free men, it would be understood that all men are mortal, and furthermore, that all men have mortal shortcomings. It is not corruption, it is the absence of corruption that should be astonishing. It would be understood that when you consider a president, or a ditch digger, or any other human being, you must consider him on his record. You must look for the evidence. The willingness to assume that there was something unholy about criticizing Pharaoh, our incarnate God, our master of our destiny, the super being in the White House, was simply an indication that we have a considerable population composed of people that evidently wants and deserves a master. And that is Aristotle's definition of the born slave. Now, socialism is the centralized and omnipotent government which, of course, has control over all economic activities. The perfect form of it, though often, the true form of it, though often very inefficient, is to be found in the typical Oriental despotism. We speak of absolute monarchies in the West. Remember, the Western tradition has never permitted absolute monarchies. Louis XIV might say, l'état c'est moi. But Louis XIV did not have, even in theory, absolute power in France, such as a Turkish or a Muslim caliph, whether Turkish or otherwise, such as a Hindu Raja, such as a Chinese emperor, would enjoy by definition. Our more recent demands for socialism come from the union of sentimentality on the one hand and discontent with civilization on the other, with this latent tendency to prefer a kind of society in which men can live by instinct and will not have to think for themselves. You can trace it back to the 18th century, particularly Jean-Jacques Rousseau, repulsive crackpot who wandered about Europe, putting his secretly, clandestinely leaving his bastards in foundling institutions, and then going home to meditate on how pure and virtuous his heart was, incidentally leaving his illegitimate offspring in foundling institutions maintained by the Catholic Church, and then going home to attack all organized religion. In a moment of rare candor and lucidity, Rousseau told Boswell the truth when he said, "I live in a world of fantasies, and I cannot tolerate the world as it is." Hence comes the myth of the noble savage, which came around to the myth of the noble despot as its parallel. On the one hand, you have the Rousseauistic tendency to dream of a beautiful world in which all you have to do is lie under the breadfruit tree and wait for the breadfruit to drop into your mouth, spending your time between drops of breadfruit in the joys of promiscuity. But on the other hand, you have the slightly more advanced form of primitivism, wants to get back not to the utterly impossible anarchy of the Polynesian islands, but to the noble despot, the Pharaoh again, who will shepherd well the cattle of God. You will find some very good indications this tendency in 18th century thought among the philosophes. I imagine many of you have read the memoirs of Casanova, who is something of an intellectual, you know. You will recall the once celebrated Madame d'Urfey, who was not the object of one of Casanova's rather commonplace seductions, but instead the principal source of his income for a large part of his career. Madame d'Urfey was one of the wealthiest and most brilliant women in France. She was not only learned in the usual sense, but she was a chemist of some skill and had installed an elaborate laboratory in her home. She is credited with the invention of a laboratory furnace, which would automatically maintain a relatively constant temperature for many days, and that was something quite difficult at that time. Casanova probably is telling the truth when he tells us that Madame d'Urfey insisted on crediting him with far more knowledge and skill than he himself had claimed, and that she herself dreamed up the project for which she lavished so much money on him. He's probably telling the truth when he says that he sought to escape performing the operation which she demanded. You may remember what it was. Madame d'Urfey was tired of being a woman, and she insists that Casanova make a man of her. She firmly believed that was possible because she had the same superstitious faith in the wonders of science that we see among our contemporaries. And of course, she eventually killed herself with an overdose of drugs intended to hasten the wondrous transformation. Casanova justifies himself, you will remember, by saying that if he hadn't fleeced the old fool, someone else would have got her money. I think that is a prime motive in socialist agitation in all recent history. You're opening up a career for someone to fleece the general public of its money. We may think Madame d'Urfey a fool for having believed in the possibility of such an operation, but was it, after all, much more fantastic, much more contrary to the ascertained and obvious facts of nature, much more irrational than the tommy rot about noble savages, brotherhood, equality, world courts, and the like, that some of her contemporaries, notably Rousseau, Helvetius, Saint-Pierre, and their kind, were busily peddling to persons as credulous as she? I think we can trace socialism in modern times down to the coming of Marx, after which it ceases to be a doctrine and becomes a pretext for conspiracy. Before Marx, the great name is that, of course, of Henri de Saint-Simon. I put him before you particularly because there is available an excellent biography by an American scholar, Mathurin Dondo. Professor Dondo is himself a liberal, and he has written this biography of the person who is generally described as the founder of modern socialism. Dondo, however, is not a full liberal. He recognizes evidence when he sees it, and he reports it without untruth. He has consequently shown us what kind of man Saint-Simon was. He was, to put it briefly, a pathological liar who seems never to have told the truth about anything when he could possibly avoid it. He was an unprincipled opportunist who lived under every government in France from the Ancien Régime to the Restoration, and more agile in conscience than the Vicar of Bray. He proclaimed that each new government was the realization of his long-cherished ideals and went on proclaiming it so long as he had the prospect of getting regular handouts from the Treasury. He was a debauchee, given to abuse of alcohol, narcotics, and women. And while we may pardon men for almost any sensuality, our stomachs must turn at the thought of the hypocrite who makes his vices odious by claiming that his debauches are the result of a high-minded urge to do sociological research. Saint-Simon was from the first either a conscious fraud or subject to hallucinations. For he used to go into dark rooms and hold long conversations with Charlemagne, who he said was his ancestor. Saint-Simon had wonderful revelations in that dark room, reporting, among other things, that Charlemagne's ghost was simply tickled to death, that Saint-Simon, his lineal descendant, was the greatest philosopher of the modern world. Saint-Simon was also a resourceful man with a fine sense of social value. After he had talked a wealthy businessman into endowing him with an annual pension, he went on to seduce or compromise that man's wife and so increase his income by levying secret blackmail on her. All this and more Professor Dondo reports in his book, but at this point he comes up against the pet superstitions of our contemporary intellectuals. For 150 years ago, Saint-Simon, while he was extracting fast bucks from the boobs, fast francs from humanitarians, put out a lot of bunk that is still fashionable. He denounced colonialism and said that it was the duty of prosperous nations to provide technical and financial assistance to underdeveloped countries so as to industrialize the whole world and make everyone as happy as larks. He proved how awfully simple it was to abolish poverty everywhere by applying science to the twin problems of raising everyone's standard of living and organizing social justice everywhere to ensure world peace. He proved conclusively that by the year 1814, modern weapons had become so destructive that war was simply unthinkable, and he was a vociferous apostle of a United Nations to replace war with world cooperation. The stale old nonsense is, of course, still the stock in trade of the liberal establishment, which hasn't had a new idea, just as it hasn't learned anything in 150 years. This, I think, will bring you up to the coming of Marx. And with Marx, you reach the period of the international communist conspiracy, in which socialism is merely a front, a pretext, a disguise for world conquest. And you have Marx's program not intended to be taken seriously as an intellectual analysis of economy, but as suggestions for the destruction of society. Marx knew, and the intellectuals who promoted it in this country knew when they promoted it, what the income tax, for example, was supposed to do. But you will remember how that was promoted. The public was deluged with articles pointing out that anybody with a big brain could see that there was no danger in the income tax because the income tax could never exceed 5% on the income of millionaires. Couldn't exceed that because no government could conceivably spend more money than that. And so they told the American people, just come little boobies, stick your heads in the noose, and we will do you lots of good. And now as you, the slaves of the Internal Revenue Department, realize what it means to have that noose about your neck, you can estimate for yourselves, I think, the necessary and inevitable consequences of both socialist and communist thought.